Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Boston Book Festival here at the Boston Public Library. My name is David Leonard, president of the library, so it's also my job to... It is my job also to welcome you to your library, because it is your library after all. I am thrilled today to be the moderator for this session, and we have two spectacular guests who will take us on a journey through the Renaissance and what that might mean for us in today in the 21st century. Walter Isaacson is best known for his work on Steve Jobs, Benjamin Franklin, Henry Kissinger. He's been CEO of the Aspen Institute, chairman of CNN, and history professor at Tulane. Raimi Targoff, professor of English and Italian studies at Brandeis, has worked on public devotion in early modern England, work on John Donne, and an intriguing topic called posthumous love, Eros and the Afterlife in Renaissance England. Whoa. And both of them are here to talk about their most recent works, Walter's work on Leonardo da Vinci, and Raimi's work on Vittoria Colonna, a Renaissance woman. Please join me in welcoming my two panelists. So our format for the next hour, we're going to ask each of our panelists to speak for about 6 or 8 minutes or so and just give us the context of their work. We'll then have a conversation for about the next 20 or 30 minutes and so forth, and then we'll open it up for a few questions from the audience. So that's the plan. And I would now like to invite Raimi Targoff to kick us off on her work.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here today. And I know Debbie's not here, but thanks to Debbie Porter for organizing this wonderful session. It's very exciting to be with Walter and talking about these books. I'm just going to begin, unlike Leonardo, who I'm sure many of you have heard of, you've probably not all heard of Vittoria Colonna. And I wanted to just talk for a few minutes about who she was and about how I came to write this book. Around 6 years ago, I was finishing the book whose title intrigued David on posthumous love, and a colleague asked if I was doing anything in the book with the sonnets of Vittoria Colonna, and I confessed to him, and I confess to you today, that I'd really never heard of her before. I decided to take a look. I couldn't find a modern edition of her poems in print, and that turns out to be the case, in Italian, forget about in English, they'd never been translated into English. I did find at the Rare Books Library, the Houghton Library at Harvard, a copy of her poems from 1538. And that turned out, as I soon discovered, to be a landmark publication. It was the first book of poetry or of literature of any kind ever published by a woman in Italy. When I read Vittoria's sonnets that day at the Houghton Library, I was really taken aback by her voice. It was a very frank, very emotionally raw, very intimate voice, which I was totally unfamiliar with. And I became curious to know more about who this person was. This was really just a discovery process for me. I soon found from the very few sources that I could find, really things that you could find on the web, a Wikipedia page in Italian, an encyclopedia entry, I soon discovered that she had had a truly remarkable life. Not only was Vittoria Colonna the first woman poet ever published in Italy, but she was also a member of one of the two most important families in Rome. They still occupy prime real estate in the center of the city in the Palazzo Colonna. She was the wife of one of the leading Spanish noblemen and soldiers who was ruling the kingdom of Naples at the time. She was probably, and this is her only chance of being well-known in our world, she was probably Michelangelo's best friend. And the letters and poems and drawings that they exchanged suggest an intimacy that was very unusual for a man and woman who were neither married nor lovers. She was on a first-name basis with multiple popes, with the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, with the French Queen of Navarre, Marguerite, who called her her dear sister. She was a patroness of art who commissioned paintings from Michelangelo, but also from Titian and from Pontormo. She was a devout Catholic, as everyone was in her era, who became involved in Lutheran circles and was ultimately put on trial, or trial was prepared for her, I should say, by the Inquisition. So it's really no exaggeration to say that Vittoria was the consummate Renaissance woman who touched and was touched by almost everything that was happening during this period. I often say she was sort of like Forrest Gump, if you remember that film, of the period, except she wasn't just in the background, she was in the foreground. So I learned the bare outlines of Vittoria's life from the sources I could find, but then I hit a kind of wall. The only decent, if very dull and dry biography, it was sort of like an extended Wikipedia page. The only decent biography had been written in the 1880s by a German man. It had never been translated into English. I read its Italian translation from the 1890s. Her extensive correspondence was also unavailable, except for an edition from the 1880s, which was woefully incomplete. And as I said, there was not even a modern edition of her poems that I could get my hands on. So what I'd come upon, for those of you who have ever done research projects, was a kind of dream situation. I had a very famous woman. Really, she's the equivalent of Emily Dickinson in Italy. Everyone sort of knows her name, but a radically underexplored historical record. So this motivated me, this prompted me, as someone who's written about Shakespeare, where if you find anything new, it's a miracle. This motivated me to write her life. So over the next few years, I traveled to every place that Vittoria had lived, from the island of Ischia, which her husband's family ruled in the castle there, to the ducal palace of Ferrara, where one of her best friends, Ercole II d'Este, lived, included several stays and visits to monasteries. She liked to live above all in convents as a lay visitor. So I sort of retraced her path through Italy, which took me really from the far south all the way north. I also spent a lot of time poring over letters and documents that I found in a range of archives in Italy, most notably the family's archive. The Colonna family has an extraordinary archive which is held in the town of Subiaco, around an hour and a half north of Rome, in a beautiful monastery. So that was one place where I found a lot of materials, and then lots of other interesting experiences, including getting into the Inquisition archive in Rome. I don't know if you all know that the Inquisition is still going on, and they have an archive, and getting in there was like a Kafka story. So much of the work that I did in those archives was simply bringing back to life materials that were dormant. I was finding handwritten, scribbled pages in a handwriting that was very hard to decipher. So much of the work was simply getting those things into, you know, printed form and then translating them from Italian to English. So in this respect, I felt a little bit like an archaeologist digging up the past. The next step was to make sense of what I'd found, which were very often partial or incomplete traces of evidence, missing the one crucial thing that would make sense of everything else. So in these cases, of which there were many, I felt a little more like a detective at times. I was constantly reading backwards or reading around. So for example, I had a letter from Pope Clement VII to his beloved Vittoria Colonna, granting her a series of requests that she apparently made, but I didn't have her letter making the requests. Or on the other end of the spectrum, I had an absolutely irate letter from her brother's secretary to her brother 2 days after she died, saying, "I always thought she was such a nice person too. I don't know how she did this to your family. I'll get to the bottom of it," because she had given her money away to someone else. But I didn't have the document that she had left making that gift. So in other words, and this is very often the case when you're working on women's history, the men's letters and documents had been preserved, but hers hadn't. So I was having to kind of reconstruct a story with the missing piece at the center. So in closing, before turning this over to Walter, I want to say that the experience I had writing this book was probably exactly the opposite of his experience writing the biography of Leonardo, where every piece of paper at one point in his book, for those of you who've read it, they're actually doing DNA studies to see if his fingerprint might be on something. Every piece of paper he touched has been truly analyzed to death. And I think this speaks to the profound differences of writing the history of men and writing the history of women. Because in this case, it's interesting to think that these two figures, who, by the way, probably met, they were both very connected to Isabella d'Este, and they had lots of overlapping events, but that these two figures were, at the time, equally famous. Vittoria Colonna was immensely famous during her day. So if she was the most important woman writer in the mid-16th century, how is it that we forgot about her life so completely? And why has no effort been made really until now, to regain, to get back all of the traces that she left behind. So I'll stop with that. Thank you.
Cool. Great. Thank you. Bravo.
And we'll now invite Walter up for his context of his work to date.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be back in Boston, a town I love because it really stands at the intersection of arts and sciences, you know, at the intersection of the humanities and technology. And to me, that's the secret of creativity. All the people I've written about have loved both science and the arts, whether it's Ben Franklin, Einstein, of course, Steve Jobs. And the ultimate was Leonardo. And one of the things I noticed when I went with Bruns, my friend here, to college across the river, is you meet a lot of smart people, and eventually you discover that smart people are a dime a dozen, and they generally don't amount to much. What really matters is people being creative, people who can sort of extract the patterns of nature. And for me, Leonardo was the exemplar of that because he was probably the person in history who most was curious and tried to know the most about all that could possibly be known. He was kind of lucky. He was born in the village of Vinci as an illegitimate child, so he didn't have to become a notary like his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. And so he became self-taught. He loved to play in the streams of Vinci, put rocks, notice the swirls of water, try to figure out the math, the Fibonacci's equations of how the swirls work. Happened to be born the same year that Gutenberg opens his first print shop and Constantinople falls, so people coming from the Arab world with algebra. It is a great time to be born and to be self-taught. He gets to move to Florence, which was the Boston of its era, and in which he becomes a apprentice in a workshop of Andrea Verrocchio. People talk about Verrocchio as being an artist, but the cool thing about Verrocchio, especially for Leonardo, is that he was mainly an engineer, an architect, a mechanic, as well as a sculptor and painter. And so Leonardo, among other things, after Brunelleschi has done the most famous dome you can imagine, it was up to young Leonardo at age 12 or so, working with the other apprentices, to put that copper ball on top of the Duomo in Florence. There's a picture of Florence when Leonardo arrived around 1470, and he makes concave mirrors so that he can focus the light, solder the copper ball, and it becomes a complete work of both art and engineering. And what Leonardo does in that workshop is not only engineering, but things like pageants and plays and the props for plays and the science, some anatomy. They do dissections. And so just as a teenager, he's getting to put together engineering and art and beauty and science, just in the way that somebody like a Steve Jobs would say the reason he was successful is that unlike Bill Gates and others, he could connect beauty to technology. Among the things we have from Leonardo, as Raimi said, is we have lots of pages of his notebook. This is just one. There are more than 7,200 pages. I got to go with my wife because nobody's ever collected them. So you have to do a lot of work. You have to go to Venice and Florence and Milan and Paris and Windsor. It's a tough job. But the cool thing about his notebooks is that he tries to squeeze everything onto a page. That's one of the types of characters he had in his plays, the craggy warrior. But he has a tree growing into the torso because Leonardo has discovered what is now called Leonardo's law of branching, that the branches of a tree, the cross sections, add up to the area of the cross section of the trunk. But what he also discovered was that's true of our arteries and veins. And so he's writing about that and showing the tree growing into it. The swirls of water, he's now still doing the math of them, but trying to do curls of hair. He also is totally obsessed with the ancient puzzle of squaring the circle, making a square, the exact same area as a circle, using only a protractor and ruler, something that's difficult to do mathematically because pi is an irrational number and hadn't yet been discovered. And then there are all the questions he wants to ask himself. Every week he lists questions. among them on there is, "Why is the sky blue?" Something that struck me because we see it every day, but we don't pause to think about it. It also struck me because it was in Einstein's notebook. People like Einstein and Leonardo are just curious about things we see every day but don't pause and think about. He also writes on there, "What does the tongue of a woodpecker look like? Describe the tongue of a woodpecker." I mean, who wakes up one morning and decides, "I'm curious"? You know, how would you find, you have to get a woodpecker, you know, open the mouth, I mean, you know. But that's Leonardo. And finally, in the very bottom of that, is a recipe for hair dye. You boil nuts in oil to make blonde or tawny, put hair dye. And you realize, oh, he's kind of vain, too, because here he is turning 32 and worrying about going gray. He also, as I said, does the props for the theater, and we call him the inventor of a helicopter. Well, that was originally to bring angels down from the rafters in a play they were doing. But the cool thing about Leonardo is he always connects fantasy to reality. He always wants to sort of turn the imagination. And so the rest of his life, he's looking at ways to build flying machines. You can see it all come together in his art. The Last Supper, first of all, if you look at it and you look at the forehead of Jesus and you imagine the lines coming out, it's perfect mathematical perspective. Everything comes out that way. But he has a trick, which is that the walls are coming in a bit faster. And you think, why? And then you realize he's a theater designer. He's done that with scenery on a stage, and so he can make it look deeper. And instead of, and this is one of the first things he invents in art, is the notion of showing inner emotion as a dramatic narrative, as if it's a scene in a play. So you can imagine them walking in, seeing Jesus who's saying, "One of you shall betray me." And then the sound ripples out to the first set of apostles on either side, and they're saying, "Is it I, Lord?" The next verse. And then as it ripples out and they're protesting, it bounces back. You almost imagine him with the next verse saying, "He that dippeth his hand," you see Judas dipping his hand, and finally Jesus reaching forward for the bread and the wine and the institution of the Eucharist, which comes next in the Gospels. So you see everything from the science to the drama and the theater. The only thing that's an anomaly is the lights on that right-hand wall, and the light seems to be coming in if you see Jesus' cheek, but the windows are in back. And you think, well, why did he do that? And then when you go to the refectory in Milan, it's really cool. You walk in, you look, no windows in the room except for one. It's on the left-hand wall, and you realize he's painting it as if the light is coming in from the real window, once again blending the fantasy and the reality. It all becomes an icon in the greatest drawing ever done. Leonardo and a group of friends were interested in architecture. They hated the Milan Cathedral. It was too Gothic. They believed that simplicity was the ultimate beauty. They wanted to just do a perfect Greek cross transept circle in a square. And they go to Pavia, where they're going to together work on this. At the castle of Pavia is one of the manuscripts of Vitruvius's, the ancient Roman architect's, book on architecture. As Stephen Greenblatt, or as we call him here, Stephen Targoff, wrote in the Swerve, the rediscovery of these classical manuscripts were part of what made the Renaissance what it was. So they rediscover Vitruvius, who's written about all the proportions of a human and how it should be reflected in the proportions of a church. Leonardo is such a geek, he does 240 measurements, anatomical measurements, even though Vitruvius has the measurements in his treatise of the navel to the genitals to the knee to the ankle. But Leonardo does it with his own apprentices sitting and jumping and moving. And so when he finally does it, the other three friends do kind of stick figures. I mean, they're in my book. They're really ugly little drawings. And then Leonardo does something that's just unnecessarily beautiful as his illustration for the book. First of all, Vitruvius had said the navel's in the center of the earth, but the genitals are the center of creation. And so Leonardo takes the genitals and puts it right in the center of the square. But then if you visit it in Venice, you see the protractor point he is stuck in the navel and makes the circle so that the navel's the center of the circle. In doing that, the circle has to go up higher than the top of the square. And what happens is you square the circle. You have something of the same size. And to him, that was almost spiritual, that the way the spirit of a human fitting into the cosmos, drawn the proper way, would be a way of doing the mathematical puzzle of squaring the circle. It also is, as I say, an absolutely beautiful piece of art, a beautiful piece of anatomy, a beautiful piece of math. But when you stare at it too, you look at the face, the strong jaw, the curly blonde or maybe dyed blonde hair, and you realize it's a self-portrait. It's Leonardo saying, how do I fit in to this cosmos, which was the ultimate quest he was always on. It culminates, of course, with the greatest painting ever done. He's dissected the human eye so that he knows we see details in the center of the retina, but we see shadows and colors from a little bit off. Like if I'm looking at one person, I can see the shadows and colors. So if you stare right at her lips, especially the right lip, even the left lip, the details go down, but the shadows and colors go up. 16 years he's working on this, painting layer after layer. So as you move, as your head changes, as you just tilt a little bit, the smile is interactive. She reacts to you. The smile disappears. If you look too strongly for it, then it reappears as you move your head. It makes it so it's an inner enigmatic mystery. But like every one of his paintings, from his beginning portrait when he was a teenager of Ginevra da Benci to the baptism of Christ, it has the rivers coming down from ancient creation, moving through, connecting to civilization, and then connecting us to all of creation. And when he died in the arms of, perhaps in the arms of the King of France, François Premier, Leonardo has carried that picture with him, not delivered it to the cloth merchant who commissioned it, for 16 years, along with St. John the Baptist and his St. Anne, because he never liked to relinquish his paintings. And at the very end, he's still working, putting layer after layer of thin glaze on that smile. He also is still working in his notebooks. I went to see the last notebook page we know that he wrote. And once again, it's two-thirds of a page, and he's still trying to square the circle. He's got a trick Euclid did of a right triangles, different lengths legs, has a chart, shows you what you... And then finally, the last line breaks off a bit, and he says, but the soup is getting cold. You can imagine him in his bed in Amboise, in the Clos Lucet on the grounds of Amboise, still trying to get us one step closer to the spirit manifest in the laws of the universe. But the soup was getting cold. Thank you. Almost on time.
Thank you both very much for introducing us to your work in brief. I'm interested to start out in... you know, when you look at someone's life and you're looking at their personal story, but you're also looking at their body of work, whether that be this wonderful set of poems or these very diverse set of creations that Leonardo has left us, how do you balance when you're putting your work together? How much of this should be biography? How much of this should be a study of the productivity, if you will, of the artist that you're looking at?
I'll start. I think for me, the interesting thing writing this book as a trained literary critic was to take the poems out of the center. And I don't know if this, I think actually it would probably be different for you, but the poems became for me, or I used them in this book, less as aesthetic objects that I was fascinated by than as a lens into someone's inner life. And so I decided to think about the poems, in effect, as diary entries or confessions, as a kind of personal practice of writing. I was given a hint, as it were, by Vittoria herself, because the very first line of her very first poem, I translate as, I write only to vent my inner pain. So she never wanted her poems to be published. She never brought them to the press. When they were published, it was in a pirated edition. They were then published 12 more times in the next 10 years, so I feel she maybe protested too much, to quote Shakespeare. But still, she didn't actually seek publication. She didn't need any kind of attention. But so in making that decision, I was really following, in effect, her cue, that she was using these poems to quote Freud as a way of working through. She was working through the death of her husband. She was then working through a set of spiritual crises. And the poems, therefore, were my, the poems and the letters, the two sets of written texts, were my best access to her. So it was a kind of vehicle to get to the person rather than a sort of artifact that I was interested in per se.
The connection of the biographical to the work has always been controversial among scholars. And I admire Raimi for doing something that's very biographical, because when we were in college, the academy and, you know, scholars kind of looked down on biography as if the work should stand for itself, and we were imposing some biographical framework on it. I remember we had a professor who didn't have tenure, a young professor, Doris Kearns, and she taught the presidency, and she wrote her big book, the first thing she published as an untenured professor, Lyndon Johnson, a biography, and she did not get tenure because the Harvard Government Department and History Department both felt that biography was a artificial construct for doing history. This is wonderful because it left biography as a field for a good 20, 30 years to non-academics, meaning Doris Kearns Goodwin, Robert Caro, David McCullough, and then in the next generation, you know, I got to benefit because you have Meacham and Evan Thomas, myself and others who were non-academics. When you do Leonardo, it is hard to disentangle the man from the work because he wasn't just a painter in which the 15 or so paintings stand alone. You have this notebook, which is a beautiful record of a mind dancing with nature. And if you have that record, you certainly would want, as I did, to base the book on his life and mind as recorded in the notebooks and then reflected in the engineering and the art.
I guess this tension between scholarly work within the academy and scholarly work outside of the academy that I think illustrates that. But both of these individuals, because I have read both books, seem to have struggled in early life to not be known for their work. I think Leonardo was very much a tradesman to begin with and was simply considered himself on a quest, not necessarily the accomplished artists that we think of him now, or that many of the commissions in later life would certainly speak to. And, you know, also I think, you know, how acceptable was it for Vittoria to be an artist and a poet at that time in the 1500s, in the middle of the late 1400s, early 1500s? How acceptable were they both able to establish themselves, or is that a modern construct that just doesn't apply?
Want to begin?
I'm actually more interested in what you're going to say.
That's fine. Well, given the fact that she was the first woman ever published, that tells you a couple things. One of the things it tells you is that this was not an available vocation for women. It also tells you things about the publishing market and other things. But just to speak to your question, I don't think she ever in a million years would have imagined herself or identified herself as a poet in any kind of public sense. So she began writing poems when her husband died, and she was in her mid to late 30s. And the poems were published when she was 48. So there was a long life, and she died at 57. So there was most of the life she was not known at all as a poet. That said, once the sort of floodgates had opened, by the end, so in 1537, there had never been a woman published in Italy. By 1600, 200 women had been published in Italy, 13 in England, 20, I think, in France. So the point is, Italy became really the pioneering country for women's poetry, and she licensed that. She licensed that because she had a reputation for being she was an aristocrat, for being incredibly elegant and intellectual aristocrat. She had sort of no strikes against her. Many of the other poets actually were either middle class, or a number of courtesans started publishing poetry in Venice. And in all of those volumes, they refer to her as having been their example. Like, she really created a way to be a woman poet. But to ask the question, it's almost, inconceivable for her to have thought of such a thing, since there simply were no other models. And when she actually struck up a friendship with Marguerite de Navarre, who had published poems in France, she says, "I've looked up and down the peninsula, Italy, looking for a model, and I found one in you." So she was actually trying to find someone else, another woman whom she could follow.
That's cool. Back then in the late 1400s, artists did not sign their paintings. In fact, most art was done in studios as sort of a group effort. Leonardo does an angel in the river and the baptism of Christ. Others paint the different figures. And so that notion of being known as an artist and becoming famous as an artist was just beginning to happen back then. But when he was young, that was not the thing he did. He also didn't like to think of himself as an artist. That was a little bit lower rung than being an engineer or a designer. And so he famously, as a young man in his teens and 20s, while he's still in Florence, probably his two greatest works are works that he doesn't finish, Adoration of the Magi and St. Jerome in the Wilderness. This is not good because his father had notarized the contract, so he's in a little bit of trouble with his dad. Those of us who have kids who are in their 20s kind of know the feeling. What happens is he decides then to leave for Milan, both because of the problems with his dad, that he hates being forced to do all this painting stuff. And he gets to Milan and he writes a letter to the Duke of Milan that's the best job application letter ever written. It's 11 paragraphs long, and the first 10 paragraphs are all about engineering. I can make great buildings. I can design the diversion of the course of waters. I can make weapons of war. It's only in the 11th paragraph that he says, I can also paint and sculpt as well as any person. And so early on, when he's doing, he first gets there, the first thing he does is this cathedral in Milan, which he hates, and then doesn't get the commission to do, but then goes to Pavia to do what becomes the sketch of Vitruvian Man comes out of. He calls himself the engineer and artist to the Duke of Milan. It's only after he starts painting the Last Supper and crowds of people come visiting every day as he's painting it that he realizes you can become a star artist. And then famously he goes back to Florence and he and Michelangelo, rivals, both living in that city, are each commissioned to do paintings on the opposite wall of the council house in Florence because suddenly artists are become celebrities.
Both of our stars traveled a lot in Italy. I was surprised to realize how much they moved around, whether it was Florence to Milan, the north to the south. That strikes me as being uncommon, but maybe I'm wrong on that point that people move around that much.
Well, in this case, Leonardo took like the Trenitalia express route. He was in all of the capitals, right? He was in Milan and Florence and so forth. Vittorio Colonna, one of the fun things writing this book was it took me to places in Italy that I had never even heard of. So she really lived. She grew up in the Castelli Romani outside of Rome in the to the east of Rome, sort of, if you ever come into Ciampino Airport, sort of just out there where there are a series, her family owned 14 feudal castles there. And that's where she grew up, there and in Naples. But then, as I just briefly sketched, she really moved around all the time. And I don't know how common that was for a man, but this was incredibly uncommon for a woman. It was absolutely unheard of. She was restless. She didn't want to remarry. She didn't want to settle down somewhere. And she kept moving. Very often, in this case, she was following her favorite preacher. She was sort of a guru. She had a guru, excuse me, and she was a groupie. And she would follow him. She'd say, you know, Ochino's preaching in Lucca next week, so I'm heading there. And then she'd go to Lucca, and then she'd follow him over to Arezzo or wherever he was. So she had a kind of unusual liberty. And that was all made possible by her class position, but also by the fact that she didn't marry, and she lived mostly in convents. So that was a sort of protective place. So yeah, she really never stayed in one place for more than 2 or 3 years when she was a widow.
I was actually surprised at the opposite, at how little somebody like a Leonardo traveled. As you say, it's only, most of his life, it's only Rome, Florence, and Milan. He writes about the Arab world. He writes about, but he never pushes himself to go out the time that he moves from Florence to Milan, he's 30. He's basically never been out of the Florence area with Vinci. And he went as a cultural diplomat because the Medici family had to sort of curry favor with the other city-states. And Milan was a great military power, but Florence wasn't. I mean, Florence had a really ragtag, poor army. It lost, I think, twice to Pisa during Leonardo's childhood, which is almost as bad as like losing to the Houston Astros or something. You don't want it to happen. And so he's sent by the Medici to be a musician and designer and whatever to the court in Milan. And that's the first time he travels, is at age 30 or 31. Huh. I mean, leave aside Vinci to Florence, which is about 60 kilometers. Yeah.
Both mentioned religion in various ways as being part and parcel of this period. I mean, we're moving here from late medieval times into early to mid Renaissance period, where religion and political power are pretty much intertwined. For Vittoria, it seems to be part of her process of grieving as a widow and trying to work out where is her role in society early on. And certainly Leonardo becomes dependent on many people of power at the intersection of religion and political power for commissions and so forth. Could you just take that and run with it a little bit, just so we understand how perhaps different that time period was from our own with respect to the role of religion in society?
Well, Leonardo was surprisingly not that faithful and religious in the conventional sense at a time when it was just beginning to be possible not to.
One of the first humanists in some
ways.
Yeah,
the first humanist. And he is a humanist and a discoverer, a precursor of the scientific method. And so, hand me my book real quick. So he does things like dissect humans, which was not exactly beloved by the church. And, he ends up doing the fetus in the womb, one of the great drawings. And if you look at that page, it talks about when does the fetus have life on its own, and it's about how it's breathing the fluid from the mother and being nourished by it, and so therefore it doesn't have a soul. And he's contradicting the church, by the way, contradicting the church today. It's still a debate that until the fetus is viable. Also, he does fossils, and he shows that the account of the flood is wrong, the deluge is wrong, because there are many, many, many layers of fossils, and he says it couldn't have happened in the biblical way. When he gets to Rome, finally, and his patron is the brother of the Pope, but back then, popes weren't that religious either. I mean, he was one of Leonardo's patrons was Caesar Borgia, who was the son of a pope, so you can tell they weren't quite the same as they are today. But when Leonardo gets to Rome, he gets in trouble because he keeps doing dissections, which the church can't figure out whether that's right or wrong. And even though he professes on the deathbed there, you do see a cardinal being brought in. There's not much in him in his notebooks other than the occasional criticisms of church teachings, which was quite unusual.
And by contrast, I would say Vittorio Colonna was deeply religious, and it was hard for me as a secular person sometimes to understand some of the depths of practice that she would go to. She beat herself. She starved herself, all out of excessive devotion. Actually, they needed to bring in at one point in her life a medical doctor from Padua to try to get her to eat. And he said, we need a priest. That there's nothing medical we can tell her. She needs someone to feed her spirit, to tell her that she needs to nourish her body. God doesn't want her to starve herself. And probably the biggest surprise in her life, which I mentioned very briefly, was here's a woman whose great uncle was Pope Martin V, who solved the great schism of the papacy, who, is a daughter of one of the most, powerful Catholic families in Europe. And just the way you fall in love with someone, she got whacked by Lutheranism. Something about it just reached her so deeply that she actually said that Luther's commentary on the Psalms was her favorite book. And we know that because when one of her friends was put on trial by the Inquisition and was executed a couple of weeks later, they started to ask him questions about her and what she was reading and what she was doing. And he offered that piece of information, another sort of backwards piece of information that we have. But this was a moment, it's a little bit later than Leonardo. We're talking, she was born 40 years later, so she was born in 1490. So when she was really grappling with her religion, we're talking about the decade just before the what we used to call the Counter-Reformation, we now call the Catholic Reformation, but just before there was a sort of permanent break between Rome and Northern Europe and the Protestants. But in that moment before, things looked really uncertain. In other words, reform activity in Italy was very, very active. There were Protestant or proto-Protestant circles. They were reading Luther. They were discussing all kinds of ways to reform the church. So she had a really deep connection to Protestant, private, internal practice. And that actually is what brought her and Michelangelo together. That was the absolute glue in that friendship, was that they started going to what we would call a lecture series together, a series of lessons, they called them, which wasn't the church service, but what followed the church service in Rome at San Silvestro, on the epistles of St. Paul. And she and Michelangelo would meet there every Sunday. And then afterwards, they would have conversations about the doctrine of justification by faith alone, of whether there's predestination. And Michelangelo really looked up to her as a kind of religious guide. And he wrote many poems to her about that. But if you look at the three drawings that he gave her, you know, to his sort of boyfriend, he gave drawings of, you know, the rape of Ganymede and so on. to Vittoria, he gave the beautiful Pietà that we have here in Boston at the Gardner. She was writing a poem about Mary at the same moment and about the Pietà. So they were both working on this together. He gave her the Crucifixion, which is in London, one of his most magnificent drawings. And then he gave her a drawing that's lost, which is Christ and the Samaritan woman. So in all three examples, we have moments of extreme intimacy. In two of those examples, of a woman and a man together having a private conversation. And they both shared this passionate belief that the church, the setting of the church, wasn't where religion should happen. It should happen inside of you.
I add one more thing that I think is key to understanding Leonardo that gets at him not being a follower of dogma, following the church, which is why he becomes sort of a precursor of the scientific method, is that he was so essentially an outsider and a miss. I mean, Steve Jobs wrote about his to the misfits, the rebels, the round pegs in the square hole. I mean, that was Leonardo. When he comes at age 12 or so from Vinci to Florence, he is illegitimate, he's left-handed, he's gay, he wears short purple tunics, he's a vegetarian, and he's a heretic. And they love him because Florence is a very tolerant town then. And so Leonardo got to relish himself as being an outsider who didn't follow dogma, and that applied both to the church and to the prevailing science.
I was going to go to the area of relationships and sexuality, but you've already sort of, I think, made some of those connections.
Oh, we can't help ourselves. We just steer there.
With now these three individuals, if we include Michelangelo for a second, an ascetic, two incredibly creative. They wouldn't have used the word gay, but we would. Do you think they knew each other? I mean, do we know that they did? Or
Michelangelo and Leonardo?
No. but you can certainly expound on their relationship, too. But a little rivalry, perhaps. Did Vittoria and Leonardo, could they have met? Did they meet? They moved in the same circles, I think, as you.
You know, said. Leonardo was enamored of the d'Este women, and Isabella d'Este, I think, is a very close friend of Vittoria Colonna. And Isabel d'Este, who they were from Ferrara, but that family moved quite a bit. She kept trying to commission paintings from Leonardo and was almost a groupie. I don't know, so I'll leave it to you as to whether Vittoria Colonna met him.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's interesting is, although we now think of Leonardo, obviously, as one of the greatest figures of the past, they wouldn't have broke bread together. In other words, he wouldn't have been invited to her parties. He wouldn't have been having dinner at the Este fancy dinner with the aristocrats in the north. I know that he worked a lot, obviously, with the Sforza family. She was very connected to the Sforza family. There are wonderful accounts of her attending weddings for which Leonardo prepared the pageantry. But was he a guest at that wedding? Probably not. Or in any case, it's interesting to think about the class issues as well, because with Michelangelo, you know, one of the reasons he looked up to her was Michelangelo was, you know, a middle-class Florentine, and she was this almost a princess, you know, so there were really strong class differences. Vittoria, as I said, commissioned paintings from Titian. She asked Titian for a Mary Magdalene. She asked that he get it done in a few weeks' time. She was very impatient, and we think the beautiful, very erotic painting that's at the Pitti, if you can conjure it up with lots and lots of hair covering her only partially covered body, we think that was probably the Titian that was painted for her, you know, Pontormo, Michelangelo, but we don't have a direct link to Leonardo.
Right. We're going to open it up for questions in a moment. So please, there are two people roving with microphones. Please raise your hands. I think both of you have also brought forward.
I love Boston. They always raise their hands. You go to like Cleveland and it's dead silence. You know?
We have something to say in Boston. So let's start here, and then we'll work our way around.
I'm fascinated that you mentioned the artwork with the Samaritan woman. Because, as you know, in the Gospels, extended dialogues of any kind, let alone extended dialogues with women and Jesus, are rare. And perhaps the dialogue between Jesus and the Samaritan woman is, in fact, one of the longest. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very, very interesting observation. And I think it's not a coincidence that I was just seeing if I could find the passage where we have a letter from her responding to the drawing that he made. I think it's not a coincidence that he drew that particular scene for her, although, as you say, it's rare. There are other moments that he could have chosen as well. And I think she absolutely appreciated. She refers to the fact that he chose that scene. I don't think she asked for it, but she took that as a sign, maybe even of their conversation that they had. Thank you.
Next question down front.
Sounds good. Good to see you 2 days in a row, Mr. Isaacson. I had a quick question about kind of being the jack of all trades versus, like, you know, jack of all trades, master of none, versus being a polymath. You know, a lot of the subjects that you wrote about in the biographical scenario. And kind of curious to hear what really sets them apart in a sense. Is it really the connection of reality and their imagination? And the second question was maybe a little bit more about Da Vinci's mirror writing.
Like on mirror writing. Yeah, I'll do the mirror writing real quick because you've seen it on the screen. If I can, well, I can't get it back up. But it was simply because he was left-handed, and it wasn't a code. Don't believe the Da Vinci Code. It, even I can read it. It's not. I mean, not well, but it's because you smudge the ink if you write in the conventional way with left hand before the invention of the ballpoint pen or whatever. On the jack of all trades, I've always been, I mean, Ben Franklin is this way, right? Steve Jobs is this way. They are interested in everything, from the tongue of the woodpecker to dissecting the human eye to how to make the inner feelings of a person reflected in her smile. And I think it just comes from being ridiculously curious, and curious in the way we all are when we're 6 or 7 years old. And we walk around, and, you know, like Einstein gets a compass, and he's like amazed that the needle keeps moving, and nothing's touching the needle. And he goes on his deathbed, he's still doing field. Now, you and I got a compass, right, when we were kids? And it's like, yeah. And then, oh, look, a dead squirrel. We're on to something else. We do not remain curious the way they do. I'm walking through a South Station, you know, in train. And I see it all the time. There's some young kid who's like pointing things out through the window and asking about, you know, why the restaurant has tables out. And finally, the father says what all parents say to kids like that is, shut up and quit asking so many stupid questions. So there is this joy of Einstein, Steve Jobs, Ben Franklin, and Leonardo. They don't outgrow their wonder years, and they keep asking those simple questions. The cool thing about being curious, and curious about everything, is that unlike the field equations of general relativity, you and I can do that. We can stop on our way over as the rain stops and you see the drops of water and it gets the glint of light. And this is something Leonardo was fascinated by. You can pause on your way across, you know, Boylston Street and just be curious about things we see but sometimes don't pause for.
Could I see hands for next questions? We'll take this question here, and then we'll take one more here, and we'll see if we can get to down front.
I just had a question when you were writing about Vittoria, and you came across all of these dead ends. How did you proceed, or where did you go from there?
It's a good question, and different circumstances produce different resolutions. But in most cases, I'll just give you the example of the will, because that was a kind of concrete example, and it also has an interesting little twist on it. So I found this letter in the family archive written by the brother's secretary, which I mentioned earlier, in which he said, you know, forget about the fact that your sister died. We're so upset about this money that she gave away, and we can't understand how she did this. And then I went to the will, which I found in the notary's office in Rome, so in a different archive, and the will didn't actually mention this gift, this massive gift of 9,000 scudi, which was like, I think Leonardo made 400 scudi a year or something. So we're talking about a massive gift. In the will, it just said, this gift of 9,000 scudi, I have mentioned in a private document that I've locked up in the mint in Venice. And no one, she said, is allowed to show it to my brother. This is what it says in the will. She says, under no circumstances can anyone show it to my brother. So then I find a record in a different source at the Vatican of a payment being made to her brother for 9,000 scudi 3 years later. So I thought, this is very strange. I can't find that document in the Mint. But just by sort of digging around, I find in London at the British Library a letter written by Reginald Pohl. Reginald Pohl, if you read my book, and I hope you'll get to this, is actually this fascinating person who is an English-born Catholic cardinal. I'll leave it at that for right now. He was the nephew of Henry VIII, the cousin of Henry VIII. It turns out that Reginald Pohl went on to become Archbishop of Canterbury, but almost became Pope. He lost by 2 votes. So that, getting back to what I said earlier about now we think of the Reformed Church and the Catholic Church as so separated, but the same person could have been the head of each of those institutions in 1557. Anyway, the letter I found in London is from Reginald Pohl saying, I, Reginald Pohl, of my own free will, under pressure from no one, as I say in the book, I picture like the gun from The Godfather at his head. Hereby give the money that Vittoria gave to me to her brother Ascanio to pay for his daughter's dowry. So I don't have the letter in Venice, but I have this evidence. And then I have the document 3 years later making this transfer when she got married. So that's a happy example in that I actually kind of figured it out. It's an unhappy example in that when we think about someone's will, both literally and figuratively, it was violated. And I don't think that happened to men. I mean, this woman was so committed to her brother not getting his hands on this money. She wanted to give the money to Reginald Pohl, she said, for pie opere, which are pious works in his country. So she wanted him to donate all of the money, and instead it paid for a fancy wedding for her niece. But that was the kind of work, and that's why I said I felt a little like girl detective, because I sort of was tracing around it, but the document itself remains lost.
Next question, please.
I know we're out of time, but Walter, I've read, I think, everything you've written, and I find it fascinating to me that in every book you've exhaustively researched everything and you present facts and you allow yourself to show yourself a little bit in most of the books. When some of the comments you might have are an opinion here and there, but in the Jobs book, there are moments toward the end where you're with him and he's going to die, and there's a lot of emotional, very sensitive emotion in your writing, but it puts you right there in the front row of the book where you're not in the front row in any other book. I wonder if you knew going into the Jobs book that you're going to let yourself go there and show yourself to the reader as opposed to being less so with the other books.
No, that's it was difficult. And as Steve was dying in August and September and then early October of 2011, I basically moved out there and was staying with him. And he, as you know, I guess, for having read that part, it was a difficult emotional time for him and his, he was having trouble relating to friends and family around him. And he was trying to figure out, what was this all about? And because he was confiding to me things that he hadn't said to others, and because he was getting so emotional himself, I almost thought it would be awkward to just try to put that as facts instead of put it in the context of him crying as he sat in the garden and we talked about life being a river. And he said, you know, I always thought that life was like a river and people put things into the river, like wonderful ideas or inventions. And if you were successful, like those of us in this room, you got to take so many of the things out of the river. And then he started talking about, now I understand that what's important is what you get to put into the river. And that whole emotional scene, as we talked about it with his feelings about his family, who he had not been very nice to, I figured writing around the fact that he's sitting in the garden talking to me and that I'm reacting to this would have been artificial. And even though you try not to insert yourself in the book, it would have lost the context because I had become, and I think at one point Bill Gates calls because he knows I'm there and says, I want to come see Steve. And Steve says, excuse my language, you know, that, well, I won't do the language, but that blank, blank, you know, he just stole everything from me. He wants to make up for it. And I said, Bill, come down. And so Bill does, and he comes, just knocks on the door and goes in. And that interplay afterwards where they're both talking to me and working it through, I felt that sometimes you become a little bit of a player in the drama and without screwing it up by forcing yourself into the drama, you're being more honest to the reader if you do it. Having said that, at the end of that, I said, no, man, next time I'm going to do somebody who's been dead for 500 years. This is a bit too much. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that.
I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative and move to my own last question, which is either from Leonardo or from Vittorio. What is the one thing that you think they would want us to take away from their work, their lives, or who they are, or maybe even just what you discovered in them? What is it that we should be taking from them today in the early part of the 21st century?
Either one. I'll let you have the last or first last word.
Well, it's a wonderful question. I would say for Vittoria, I think she probably would have wanted us to value, to appreciate the spiritual poetry that she wrote. That's the things that she cared the most about. She didn't really care that much about the love poem. She cared, but she put her entire heart and soul into having this kind of intimate spiritual life, and that's the thing that she sort of stood by. So I would say that would be her gift to us.
And for Leonardo, it was on every notebook page. You're the one who asked me the question, which is, what was the one thing? And it was curiosity. And he celebrates on every page, curiosity. And curiosity for its own sake. He talks about dissecting things so he can do the neck muscles of St. Jerome. But then he keeps saying, and then I was just curious, and I went down to the heart, and I went to the liver. And he keeps going, so he's just can't stop this insatiable curiosity for its own sake. And this is what he keeps trying to push on everybody around him, is that true creativity, true imagination, comes from being curious, not just curious, but curious about everything and being curious for its own sake. And I'll end with this, which is the tongue of the woodpecker, 3 times as long as the beak of a woodpecker. When the woodpecker's beak hits a wood with that impact, it wraps around the brain and cushions it so the woodpecker survives. Wow. There is absolutely no reason you need to know this. It is absolutely useless information, just as it was useless for Leonardo when he wrote that on that notebook page. But I thought you'd like to know out of curiosity, pure curiosity. Thank you.
And so on this note of call to openness to curiosity and call to openness to spirituality, we'll end this session. Our two panelists will be out in the lobby momentarily for book signings. Please join me in thanking them one more time.
Come on.